This podcast is part of the Shareable Podcast Network. Learn more at shareable.fm. This is Rogue. I'm your host, Jeff Gibbard. Claire, welcome to Rogue. Tell people, who are you and what is your superpower?
Yeah, excellent. Thanks so much for having me. So I did share my rogue. So then when I'm talking about my superpower, just to go full into this, I'll share my beast.
Nice.
Too. So my name's Claire Mendelsohn, aka Beast or Hank McCoy, from the X-Men. And I say that about myself because I really relate to that having two sides. I have one side that is extremely rational, logical. And then I have the other side, whether I'm in meltdown or whether I'm just enraged about an injustice, that's really that kind of fury or that fight side. So for your Star Trek fans out there, it's kind of like I'm part Vulcan, part Klingon. That kind of explains me to a T. And the superpower that I want to talk to you about today is designing and carrying out experiments. And that might sound very mundane, but it's the idea that we can actually circumvent the traps that prevent change by shifting the way that we operate on a day-to-day basis.
I love this. I'm excited to dig into this. So I think I've told you in brief about the concept of this show, and I know you have your rogue with you, but for those who are tuning in for the very first time, the concept behind the show of Rogue is modeled after the X-Men character Rogue, whose ability... do you have a rogue tattoo?
Is that I do. Rogue? I have a whole X-Men tattoo too. Sorry, I just totally derailed you. Keep going.
That's amazing. And wow, that you like, you're built to be on this show.
Indeed.
Rogue's superpower is that when she touches another mutant or another superpowered individual, she's able to take their powers. And in different storylines, that can be takes it from them and they never have it again. And other storylines, it's just she absorbs it and can have it. And sometimes it stays for a while and sometimes it stays permanently. But bottom line is, it's a show that models after the idea of being able to steal other people's superpowers. And I do it through conversation. So what we're going to do in this show is I'm going to try my very best to steal your superpower of developing a mindset around experimentation and using that to circumvent those traps. So we're going to go into a lot of different angles. I'm going to ask you a lot of different questions about this. But my job is to try and take everything you tell us in this and design a bit of a recipe, a bit of a framework, a sort of how-to guide of the most important steps it takes in order to, for ourselves, steal your superpower and incorporate it for ourselves. So that's what we're going to do today. So I think the first thing that I always like to start with, and different superpowers, this can be more or less important, but I think it's important that we start with the idea that anything that you do extraordinarily well can be used for good or for evil, right? The ability to influence people or persuade people, like that can be used for incredible things, but it could also be used for really, really horrible things. Not that anything like that would be happening in the real world right now. So what I like to do with every superpower is I like to first start with really, you know, dropping the defenses a bit, getting real with it and looking at it and saying, okay, so let's say that we follow you down this path and we learn this experimental mindset. What are some of the dangers that are present? What are some things that could go wrong? How do we make sure we're being responsible with these powers?
Wow, that's a really good question that I actually hadn't like made notes on. So I love that thinking about that from that perspective. I guess the only, you know, like, it's interesting. I had this like immediate gut feeling that there aren't any. And then, another part of my brain was like, that's not possible. Dig deeper. So I think there could be a tendency, depending on how you embraced this idea, there could be a tendency towards what I'm going to call flightiness, but I don't mean that in a judgy way. Just like increasing the flitting around, right? And not landing in your values, perhaps. That's the only thing that's coming up for me right now is it could, if used in a non-mindful way, it could increase flightiness or it could increase maybe ADHD tendencies of flitting around and not settling.
Yeah. And I think the way that I always think of the whole, this could be used for good or evil is on the one hand, there's like the consciously you could use an ability for nefarious purposes. On the other hand, there's, if you're not conscious about the ability, it could lead to adverse effects. And usually that's like, you have to push it to the very far extreme. Yeah. And it's like that whole monkey's paw thing, right? Like, you know, you say like, I want to have infinite wealth, and then you don't think of the things that come with infinite wealth. So, you know, you could develop an experimental mindset, and then all of a sudden all you're doing is experimenting, and you're not actually landing on something, or you're not, or you're questioning things that you've already anchored and settled in that you should be letting kind of guide the way and experimenting around those things. So I can see how that could potentially be a potential pitfall. So thank you for acknowledging that. So now what I want to do is very much like Rogue. Rogue, it, you know, it, those familiar with the comic know that she's always wearing gloves. And the reason she's wearing gloves is because it protects her from touching people and absorbing their power, because she's had some traumatic experiences with that. So one of the things that we have to do if we're going to absorb your superpowers, we're going to have to take our gloves off. We're going to have to feel it. We're going to have to actually touch and experience what this is. When you talk about the experimental mindset and concept, I think we get that. But can you help us really feel it? Give us an example, a story, a way that this plays out so that we can understand what it means to think in this way or be in this way.
Yeah, definitely. And so let me just say, like, I just was re-listening this morning. So this is kind of framing my thinking right now, to Nick Walker's Throw Away the Master's Tools from Neuroqueer Heresies. And it comes from I think Audre Lorde is like a poet and activist that originally said the master's tools can never dismantle the master's house. And so I'm really like framing a lot in that context right now of thinking about, how do you even change when you see something? And let me just talk about myself. How do I even change when I see something that's not working for me, that's not working in the context of what's going on in the greater society? How do I even go about changing that? And to oversimplify it, if you want to think of like three different ways of seeing that, right? There's the folks that just appear to be able to make a decision and change. Right? I want to do this. And then they do it. Then there's the folks on the other end that I tend to work more with who are baffled by that. They're like, that is magic. Like, I have all these great ideas and I can't move forward. Right. And so then we kind of move into that like executive function area. Right. Can you plan a thing? Can you start a thing? Can you do a thing? Can you finish the thing? And so there's a kind of two extremes, appear to be able to do it and appear to be totally blocked. Right. And then I also work with a lot of people in the middle that are like in a third place where they think they're doing it, but really all they're doing is talking about it. Right. And they're not actually implementing or absorbing a change that they want to make. Mm-hmm. Right. And so so for an example, so that's kind of an overview of like, why would you even consider this? Right. And I want to talk about traps and all that. But like for an overview, so like I recently have done a couple of different experiments. And one of them, I'll use a personal example. I'm just looking at my little experiment notebook here. I have a very spicy, lovely child who loves to argue. And there's not a day that goes by that I wish my mom was still alive and I could apologize to her, because I'm sure I was exactly like this. And so I did an experiment. What if I didn't argue with him for 2 weeks, right? And it doesn't mean, and like all this fear comes in, right? It's like, oh, I'm going to be condoning bad behavior and I'm going to be doing this and then and I was like, well, okay, let's just set all that aside and let's just try it and keep track of what happens. So when he would get into it and he's ready to go, man, and he's ready to argue with me. And I just say, I started making these like grunting noises. He was totally satisfied with that. Like to him, that was like, oh, he's being heard. And within a short period of time, I was like, wow, I'm calmer because I'm not engaging. He's calmer. We get through these times faster. Mm-hmm. So I got some really positive results from that really fast. And it actually led into some other work that I've talked to you about doing is in this relationship, right? There's been other times where I was like, I'm going to do yoga every morning and this is how I'm going to do it. And I flip and failed. Like I just wouldn't do it. And so it was a 2-week experiment. I tried to do it, failed horribly. And you know what? I was like, oh, okay. there's a reason why I'm not doing this. Maybe that's where my attention needs to be. Instead of like shoulding, I should do this and blah, blah, blah. So like that's an example of a failed one that actually had equally powerful results to it.
I think one of the things I want to point out that I'm noticing in the examples you just gave, there's two pieces of it. The first is when you pulled out your notebook. I want to just flag that as like a, it seems like it might actually be a really important part of the process, which is it's not enough to just say, I'm going to do an experiment and then just do it and kind of go off the vibes of how it felt. I'm noticing that you're very much in a scientific approach almost. You're saying, I have a hypothesis. I'm going to test that. I'm going to actually observe what happens and take notes of it. And then I'm going to look back on it and decide if it worked, if it didn't work, where to make interventions, where to make changes, how to revise the theory. So I think the first thing is just the keeping track of it is one thing I want to flag. The second thing I want to flag that I thought was interesting is in both examples, you had 2-week experiments that you expressed. And I think this is someplace where a lot of people who are trying to create change maybe make their job more difficult for themselves because they're talking about like, I'm going to make permanent change from here on out, as opposed to I'm going to take today and try and do something different, or I'm going to try and do something for the next 2 weeks. And it gives it this sense of like, well, I can climb that mountain. It's just 2 weeks, right? And if 2 weeks is too long, maybe you just do it for a week. And if that's too long, maybe you just do it for three days. But in either case, it seems like two of the secrets of success that you've found, or I guess things that you've found that have been useful are to keep a journal, track what's going on, and to set a period of time for whatever that change is, that it's short enough that you can run the experience, you can just try it, and it's not so long that you have a higher likelihood of falling off of it.
Exactly. And if it's cool, I'd love to like go into like a couple of things based on that, right? Like, so one, this is not a new concept in any way, right? But this can be a revolutionary shift. So it is both very mundane and everyday and can be a little bit mind-blowing. And so how I got here to this point is, I mean, I was an evolutionary biologist. That was my first career. I was a science teacher. I'm a lifelong maker, right? Which is another word for artist, but it's the whole idea that you don't really even need to know what you're doing as a maker. You just have the desire to figure it out along the way. Right. So it's just this giant experiment. And then I joke, but it's so true. I'm an anti-perfectionism punk. Right. So like I'm always wanting to just push against the edges and push away against ways of doing stuff. And then recently there was a book published called Tiny Experiments, and Laura LeCoumpf, which is a fabulous book on this topic. I would highly recommend. So this isn't like a new idea, but as far as like applying it, there's another thing you said. So one of the things you said is actually one of the three big traps that I've found in studying this and applying this. And that's the forever trap. And if you're old enough to know The Sandlot, I always imagine forever these kids do this funny thing. So, and it's that idea that if I make a change, whatever that change is, I now will have to do that for the rest of my life. You know, and this is really common in career choices. Right. Even in today's like different career setting. Right. It's that this is now I'm now going to be this thing forever. Right. And that's daunting. Right. Like that's incredibly daunting. Like, oh, I better do it right because it's going to last forever. Right. The other two is the too big trap. And that's the idea that and this really happens for a lot of us with our super brains. Right. That can view complexity really well. And you see, OK, there's all these components related to that. So if I'm going to change, I need to change everything. That just it's not even possible. Right. Like brain explodes, not even worth it. And then the last one is the perfectionism trap that like, OK, I have high standards. It's important to me to have high standards for quality. And so anything I do, it must be the best possible version of that. Right. And so those are the things that I believe are the three common things that shut people down from making a change that they actually want to make.
I feel like those are hopefully I'd imagine that those are relatable to just about all of us who have grown up and developed a career in the last like 40 years that this and probably before that, but this probably feels very relatable because I think for one, the perfectionism trap is just baked in, right? Like everything is, and you look at like who we hold up as our icons and everything is about the perfect vision that they had, the lone soul genius, all of the things. mm-hmm. it becomes this hyper individualist narrative of like, you know, just you have to be the best to be able to go beyond. You have to be exceptional, right? So there's that. And then this forever idea, I think part of it is that it can sometimes seems like the stakes of change can be so high that we either have mm-hmm. to change, and that if we do and we get it wrong, then we can't ever go back, right? That there's no ability to make a decision and then maybe double back and decide that you actually do want to do what you did, or that maybe that thing wasn't right and you pivot again. When you were talking earlier about the people that you work with and the sort of the mm-hmm. people that are at the polls, right? The people who just make mm-hmm. change and move on, and people who seem that that's difficult. In the people you've worked with and looking at your own mind and how you would adapt to change, have you found any sort of commonalities of why people tend to gravitate towards one or another? I find that change is really easy. I find it's really hard to stick to something. So mm-hmm. I'm at that one pole where it's like, I'm always thinking about like, well, I could just make it better and I could this and I can that, because I'm always seeing the new connections to things. But then I know people who even the smallest change can sometimes feel like, we're going to need to talk about this for months before we make this very small change. And I'm curious mm-hmm. if you've noticed if there's any sort of commonalities across groups or tendencies or traits or anything that would make someone more likely to be one or the other. Because to say you're an anti-perfectionism punk is like so rad, but to shed ourselves of this desire to be perfectionists and to be able to embrace change and to make it small enough and to not all of those things that probably takes something. So what have you found?
Yeah. So it was interesting that I'm really glad that you shared like your personal connection to that, because I was thinking about this and about, you know, because my language actually is others who appear to be able to decide to make the change, right?
Yeah.
And do it. And so are they really doing that or not? It's a little bit hard to tell, but there are certain people, and you are one of them, and there's a couple other people that are coming to mind in my life where I do feel like have that that drive maybe, or that ability to leap, right?
I think for me, it's a lack of attachment. It's a lack of attachment to a previous thing and a willingness to shed whatever needs to happen in service of wherever I'm going or whatever the next thing is. And also a very bad short-term memory. So,
well, and I'm highly impulsive.
That too.
Like that's how my ADHD side shows up. I'm hyperactive and highly impulsive. So both things that makes me, my risk tolerance way higher. Right. So I think there's a lot of things. I think, and maybe this is the side I don't, other than my own experience, I have the least understanding of. Right. So I think that those kind of things could be involved. Right. I think that there's probably an element of privilege involved there. Right. If your path is a little more cush, maybe it's easier to change too. But I can also see the other side. I can also argue the other side of that. If you are raised by scientists, I was raised by scientists. So if you are in a field, you know, if you're used to that kind of thinking anyway, I can see that it might be easier. Or if you're, if that's just kind of how your brain works. So that's the one extreme. I find much fewer people that fit in that category though. Right. And that's why I think that sometimes it might be our perception of others that we're just not seeing the classic. We're not seeing their insides. Right. We're only mm-hmm. seeing their outsides. What I think is interesting, what I'm particularly interested in is the other side of that. And then kind of that middle ground. I think that for the people like, you know, and one of the things I love about where I'm at is like, I work exclusively with people that are other in some way, right? So they feel like systems weren't built for them. It largely shows up in being neurodivergent, but it could be anything. It could be any way of relating to that. And so I think that marginalized folks in general have just experienced a lot more beat down, you know, and a lot more pushback for who they are, you know, whether it's like full rejection sensitivity has developed or not. There is an actually quite a bit more trauma around things. And so the ability to make a choice is a little bit harder. So I think that's one profile. Another profile, straight executive function stuff, like you're talking about, like can do a brilliant plan, get so wrapped up in the plan, use all their energy in the plan that there's no energy to start, right? or perhaps can't finish or can't close loops. Mm-hmm. But then I think the really interesting one to me too is like, and I really understand that too, right? Like that one feels a little bit easier to work with. But then then kind of in the middle where you think you're making the change, but you find yourself in that loop. One finds himself in that loop where they're just still doing the same thing over and over again. Mm-hmm. And I think that I also experience a culture of, hey, if I watch the news, I'm doing something.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a one example out of many. If I listen and I know what's going on, that's the same thing as action.
If I read the books and I learn all about the thing, or if I buy the equipment,
yes,
then
yes,
I'm doing
exactly.
The thing.
I love that example, right?
Yeah.
I love, like, I bought all the equipment. You know, okay, now
yeah,
I've got it all.
I haven't taken it out of the box, but soon,
yeah,
soon I'm gonna.
Yeah. And so it's like this feeling that, but then I'm like feeling bad about myself because I haven't actually done the thing.
So let me ask you this then, would you then say that really the critical deciding factor here is in the action itself, is in the, whether you're on either pole, that there is something where it's like, this comes down at some point to just doing a thing.
Yeah.
And so, okay, so let me continue with my last line
of
questioning into this, right? So one of the things I've noticed about, and you'll probably know this and appreciate this, but like you think about superheroes as a concept, right? And you think about superpowers as a concept.
Mm-hmm.
There are functionally three different ways that they happen narratively. One, you're born with it, a la Superman, mm-hmm. right? So mm-hmm. Some of us, to your previous example, some of us are born for the susceptibility to change. Just because of the way, where we were born, what we were, whatever, right?
Mm-hmm.
Two, something happens to us, a la Spider-Man, bitten by a radioactive spider, or some sort of a mutation introduced, and then all of a sudden something in our life changes, and then we simply have this new thing. It's, this person who suffers an accident, they can't see things the same way, and then they just are the way they are. And then the third is the Batmans, something tragic happens or something happens, and they decide to train and dedicate themselves to a particular thing. And in every case that I've seen of somebody who has a superpower, there is always a little bit of all three of them.
Yeah.
When we take into account what where we're going here with, like, you have to take the action and you look at the different tendencies at the poles, would you say that most people who have an easier time adopting an experimental mindset or a harder time developing an experimental mindset, that there's one of those or any of those sort of paths of developing the superpower that's more or less important? Is it like, You have an easier time if you were born with the propensity of it, or that you train for it, or like, kind of where do you fall on that contingency or on that continuum?
Yeah. I mean, the true answer is I don't know.
Okay.
I'm fascinated. I'm really fascinated. I have things I suspect, so I'll put those out there. Right. And I, being both autistic and ADHD myself, I in no way can say I understand autistic people or ADHD people. We have a lot more in common than I do with holistic and neurotypicals, but I don't. So one thing that I love the most is like hearing as many people's perspectives as possible, right? And kind of almost like cataloging that and taking that into account. And so that's what I've really been doing in this framework, because it was like, one thing I noticed, and I am answering your question in this crazy way, but I'm getting there, is like, this appears to be easier for me. Is that true? And looking back at like, why was I able to heavily mask and fit in and really show up as neurotypical? Why was I able to do all these things? Why was this actually easier for me? Or is there something else going on here?
Mm-hmm.
So, and I feel like I'm going to need decades more data to actually be confident in saying anything, right? But I think that's why when I was thinking about what is my superpower, that's why I gravitated towards this one. Because of a lot of, like, I could have easily talked about perfectionism too, But why I gravitated towards this one is that it clicks both of those, like all of those boxes, like you said, right? So. And in some ways, it's more helpful for people, that for the Batmans, right?
Yeah.
Or for the Spider-Mans. Like, it's more helpful because it is very procedural. The way that I do it, you know, it is very procedural. There is a formula that you can take and tweak to work for you. You can train your brain. This works really well with neuroplasticity. You know, mm-hmm. you can train your brain to think this way. And so, yeah, does that answer your question?
It does. So I want to point something out that I see in this as a fellow autistic ADHD, mm-hmm. which is, I think that among those who have who see ourselves as ADHD mm-hmm. that I've met, almost all of us have a very hard time and almost an allergic reaction to stating things with absolute certainty.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So like, there's a lot of like, I'm not going to say this for certain unless I am absolutely sure. Like, there's a very important need to be correct, not to be right, but to be correct and to be mm-hmm. accurate about what it is that we are saying. And when we cannot mm-hmm. be absolutely certain about that, we have a tendency not to fully give into that. And so I would argue that on the spectrum of things, the Supermans, the Spider-Mans, the Batmans, that I think that there is a certain built-in, baked-in relationship with uncertainty, not just a comfort
yes.
with it, but a leaning into it as mm-hmm. As a way that we tend to be that may help with that whole, let me just try it. Because it's when you yeah. become certain about something, I think,
yes.
that you're less likely to try something else, to just experiment, because you're so, it's the same reason why we see decisions as forever, right? It's because I made the choice, now I have to stick to it, right?
Yeah.
Whereas if you're like, well, I don't even know if it was the right choice in the first place, I'm just going to try it, it becomes a mm-hmm. lot easier to change directions because you're going to try something new. So
yeah.
I'm wondering if part of actually, even in the Batman case of it, let's say you're not built with that, that part of the training for this is to get comfortable with the idea of not being sure about something, because that
yes.
then frees you up to be more experimental and to just try things to see how mm-hmm. it works. And then I think it's that documentation piece that really gives it that structure for it to be an action that you can build on.
Exactly. For a couple of reasons. So for one, you know, as you were talking, I realized something about myself too. And it's like, I was very uncomfortable with uncertainty earlier in my life, like the unknown and being like fairly snappy and like, I make a decision. I want it to happen. I don't want to wait. Mm-hmm. I don't want to know. I don't want it for everybody else to decide they agree with me. I just want to go, you know? And so that's not really how most of the world works in my experience.
Yeah.
And so I've chosen to do a lot of work myself to be more comfortable with uncertainty. And I think that's a big piece too. And I think it also comes from like having a conceptual brain. I talk about this a lot, and it's that when you ask me a question, I immediately see like, okay, I could say this, 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 and this is connected to this, like this. And it's like, I see this big mind map in my, mm-hmm. and then it's like, oh shit, where do I go? You know, like which one do I talk about? And that's why, and I also don't really necessarily believe there's anything that's that true. Is like, I think there's nothing that's a fact. So I have, you know, that's why I think it's easier to go with what you were saying.
Yeah.
For me, you know, if you're viewing your whole way of seeing the world is always been a little different.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But the reason that I like this tool and then to the writing down thing, by all means, like don't expect your brain to remember how you felt in the moment and what you experienced in the moment. Like mm-hmm. give yourself little breadcrumbs that you can go back. You know, because part of it is looking at, and you can do short ones, but I really think 2 weeks is like the shortest I would recommend for most folks, because it's going to give you, and I say like, make sure you write down at least 5 things during that time. You have at least 5 data points, because it's going to give you a little bit more chance to see patterns and to see variables than
awesome.
if you're just trying to remember what felt and what you're doing, you know?
Yeah. Can you take me back to, so you mentioned that you struggled with uncertainty, and mm-hmm. I want to get into a little bit of how you learned to processify an experimental approach to things. Because I'd imagine it wasn't always a thing, and I'm sure you weren't always carrying around a change journal where you were logging five data points. So what was sort of the method by which you mentioned some sources that kind of, you know, inform this? Like, so for instance, when you mentioned the 2 week kind of thing, my first thought was BJ Fogg, Tiny Habits, or James Clear, Atomic Habits. It's like the science of habits. It's like, you gotta make it small enough that you're gonna be able to do it. You make it within reach, right? So I'm sure there's a lot of influences here. I'm curious about both the way that you went about learning to make this into a process and the thinking that sort of informed it along the way. Like, what were the sort of things that you were looking at, you were thinking about differently that you saw in others? Like, what were all of the sort of various data points that you think, if somebody were to reconstruct this superpower, what do you think it is that they need to learn and think?
So, that last little bit changed a little bit. So let me start with where I was going to go first, and then I'll end with that piece. So it really comes from what is experimental design, right? So as a field scientist for years, like when there is a question that you want to explore, there is a process of experimental design. Like, how do you design a good experiment that's going to most likely give you information about that thing that you're interested in, right? And so that is time bound. That is space bound in some way, right? Like, it defines out what's going to be included and what isn't. It's focused. And then there's procedures about, like, you know, ideally you're only really changing one thing, and you're keeping everything else constant. That's not always as possible in like day-to-day life, right? Because sometimes what you're trying to see is, what will I actually do given the chaos of my day-to-day life?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So there can be more variability, but I think my propensity, or why I would lean towards this way of thinking, as for one, it just makes a lot of sense to me. And for two, I have a lot of experience with experimental design in a scientific concept context. And then to move towards kind of the other end of that question. So then I also started being really interested in, like I said already, why am I able to just change? Like, why am I doing this and able to change and pivot? And like, sometimes I'll be 52 at the end of this week, and sometimes I feel like I have like lived four lives, you know, like I've made significant enough changes in my life, relatively easily. So I became really interested. And then I work with folks that just really struggle, right? That are really unhappy and really want a different way, and then just really struggle to find any change in their life. And so I got incredibly interested in that. Like, why is this different for us? And I actually have a whole workbook on experimental mindset practice. Like, I have a whole practice that frames it in kind of a whimsical way, because that's what I do. But so I really started looking at, okay, what are the steps? What are the steps that I'm taking because of my past experiences? And how does this translate to a day-to-day experiment? And so I was actually like in the middle of writing this workbook, and had already designed my process and had been using it with people when Tiny Experiments came out, the book. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, oh my God, I got to read that, you know? And then I read that. And in a lot of the stuff you referenced too, and it's just so affirming, you know, it's just so affirming that, yep. Like, she has a thing in there about timeframes, you know, she has a thing about all the same things that I'm talking about and experience. So I think the thread is that we were both grounded in scientific experimental design, and we both, and many people have had experiences using that in our own lives. And again, like I said, like it's learnable, it's iterative, it's personal, you can personalize it. Like, there's so many things about it that really work for especially autistic folks. You know, you can take it in whatever, and ADHD folks too, right? I work with a lot of people that have pretty harsh rejection sensitivity, you know, and we can even do little things there. Like a great example, someone was, that I work with was, she was reading she was doing the voice acting for a book. I guess not voice acting, whatever. She was reading an audio book. That was her job. And she was like, so stuck and she could not send a draft to her client. And she's just stuck. And I was like, well, what can we do to like alleviate that pressure from you? And we worked her through this process. And it turned out she decided to do an experiment where she would send a clip of her reading this to three people that she really trusted. Right. And to get feedback. And so she was checking, is my perception of what's going on here, how real is that? I mean, it's real, but how on target is that for this work? And all three people loved it. You know, maybe little tiny things here and there. And so she was like, oh, okay. I don't need to be worried about this. I can send it to the client. Yeah. So it's learnable too.
Got it. So then I guess it would be, or correct me if I'm wrong, I would say it's safe to say that from a starting point, this is about understanding how to make yourself more capable of change in the ways that you want, and that the process that you took to get there, as understanding how this works and turning it into something trainable, is that you took your background in understanding experimental design and how those things work. You learned a little bit more about, you know, you already had a background in it, but you kind of looked into it. You looked what other people said about it and mm-hmm. learned how to incorporate it in a different context of how do we incorporate mm-hmm. experiments into our lives where maybe things aren't the same as they would be under controlled circumstances. And that you pick an objective, something that you want to fix, you give it some of the same criteria you would in an experimental design, time base, you think about the space, what are the different things, what's the one thing you might change, time period you're going to look at it over. And that the thing that you're kind of looking through is like, what is the, what are the sorts of thoughts that you're confronting here? Is it perfectionism? Is it rejection sensitivity? It could be any number of different. So you're looking at like, what are the thoughts there that you are interacting with? And you're looking to make it within reach. Again, looking in the backing of habit research and experimental design research, how do you make it within reach so it's tangible for people to do it? And that's what potentially makes it actually learnable for people, because it doesn't actually matter if you're impulsive. It doesn't matter if you have rejection sensitivity. It doesn't matter any of it. It just matters that you have a place that you want to change and you can develop a small experiment in which to get there. And then you're looking at something that you're willing to examine so that you can actually make that change.
Yeah, totally. Can I just run you really quick through the nine?
Yeah, going to say, let's take it into the actual like framework. Okay. Tell us the framework. Take us through the actions of like how experimental design works.
Yeah. So these, I'll go through these and then you can direct me to more depth where you want.
Yeah.
So step one, before judgment, look at an issue or challenge in which you generally want some change or some shift. Right. So first it's like even just honing in, right? Step two, visualize both starting situation, where are you now? And also, where do you think you want to be? Right. And I use that word think because we don't totally know, right? Where are you now? Where do you think you want to be? I was arguing with my son too much and feeling really stressed out. I wanted to have a better relationship with my son. I was having a really hard time structuring my time within a day. And I wanted to feel like I could end the day having been both productive, but not burnt out. Right. Those are some examples of that. I wanted to be more physically active, right? Because I was feeling crappy. And I imagined feeling better in my body. So this is just like snap examples of that. Where are you now? Where do you think you want to be? Then before you even take off, and I like to use like journey metaphors. I know they're overdone, but they really work for me. You know, before you even take off, like pack your backpack, man. Like, what are your strengths? Like, if you haven't done a strength assessment of some sort, do one. And there's several ways you can do that, both paid and free and community-based and internet-based, whatever. So what strengths do you already have going for you, right? Are you strategic? I'm very strategic. Right. I like planning things. You know, are you creative? Are you brave? Are you kind? Are you, you know, what are your strengths? What are you bringing with you that's going to help you on this journey? Right. And then the next one you talked about a lot, right? You kind of highlighted really well just a second ago. Always trying to pull back. It's on the balcony thinking, right? So you pull yourself up to the balcony, like you're looking down at yourself. What are my obstacles? What do I think is going to get in the way of me doing this? You know, do I always have a hard time starting something? Do I always have a hard time sticking with something? Do I not take criticism well? You know, what are your obstacles? And I tend to frame these in like, what's your mountain? Like how, what's the hardest thing to do? What's your dragon? What's the scariest thing? You know, there's like various things there. Okay. So again, what's the issue? Where you are now, where you want to be? What's in your backpack? What can you bring with you to help you out? What are the obstacles? And then it's like, and then it's really just like, dump every single thing you think you could do in 2 weeks. Like, what are all the ideas you have? Like, don't like really fight going against the first one. And then like really highly encourage like silly ideas, right? Ones that feel dumb. Like I could dance, you know, I could stand on my head, whatever. Just put it all down. And then the next one tends to be the hardest for some. Sometimes I'm like, roll a dice. It doesn't even matter. You know, you got 8 of them, get out an 8-sided dice, roll it, do that one. You know, then you got to pick one of those to try.
Yeah.
One of those to try. And then track experiences honestly. Right. Do your best to be like, okay, didn't even do it today. Thought I was going to do it. Didn't do it. Felt bad, you know, whatever. So, and I tend to frame like, what did you do? What did you notice? What's the date? What'd you do? What'd you notice? Oh my gosh, I actually tried it today and I saw this happen, you know, oh, failed again. Didn't do it. Feel, you know, whatever. Just track honestly what happened. There's as much information in the times it didn't work. And then once you get to the end, when you hit, if you said it was 2 weeks, in 2 weeks, stop. Back up, look at all the things you wrote down. What do you notice? What did you learn from that? Right? And then last step 9 is, okay, what do you do now? So I frame this in 4 ways, but you could do, there could be other ways. One, hey, that just worked. I'm going to adopt that change, right? That would be ideal. Doesn't always go that way. You know, okay, sweet. That worked. 2, wow, that wasn't enough. I wish I would have had 4 weeks to do this. Sweet. Continue the experiment. Right. Set another couple of weeks. Okay. That was too easy. I actually went too easy on myself. Elevate the experiment. So do the same thing, but make it harder or add in something else. Mm-hmm. Or then sometimes throw it out. That was the wrong experiment. I'm going to go back and I'm going to pick either one of those other that I had come up with or come up with some other ideas. And then whoop. And then you just enter the cycle again. That's the thing. It doesn't totally, you know, ever end.
Okay. So I have 2 observations okay. I was putting myself through the process.
Okay.
And I noticed that there are 2 parts that made me feel a little scared. Like, ooh, this cool. part, these are the 2 parts that are gonna be difficult.
Yeah.
So the first is consistently writing down that I didn't do it. Like, so that's like the first thing that I think for me is like, it feels like a thing that would stop me from even starting to do an experiment is, knowing, you know, like to sit down and write like, oh, I didn't do it today. I'll give an example. I have multiple times over the last decade tried to do I'm going to create more video content. I'm going to put out more short videos. I'm going to try and share things that I know and help people. And 3 months in, I haven't recorded 1 single video. And I will say that had I actually sat down each day and written, I did not do a video today, I think I probably would have started recording videos because I wouldn't be able to confront that failure on a regular basis. Yeah. So the first observation I'm having is that I feel like the big challenge that I would have in this is actually sitting and writing it down. And I think that if I could build a tiny experiment around that as my first experiment of just
that's exactly what I was thinking too.
Is like, that might be the first hurdle. The second thing I wanted to just point out is that and you addressed it with the rolling of the dice. I was glad that you said that, is that how do you pick, right? Because the anti-perfectionism punk in you is like, well, you just roll a dice. But for any of us who are potentially struggling with any sort of perfectionism, we're immediately going to think, well, how do I choose the right one? What if I chose the wrong one? I only have so much time. I can't do them all. I should choose the right one. And then we choose none, right? So I think the inaction in both of these, at least from my perspective of going into this, would be, I'm afraid I'm going to pick the wrong experiment to do. And then even if I do the right experiment or pick an experiment, I may not write it down. And therefore I failed all of the pieces, even though I see the value in what you're saying. The question I would have asked you is, what action do people get wrong? But I put myself through it and I saw that those are two things I would get wrong.
Yeah. Let me ask you a question. So if you went into that decision to make video content, deciding you were going to record your experiences, would that have changed anything? Right? Because in hindsight, you didn't go into it with making that deal with yourself, right?
What deal? That
I would write it down. Like every day.
I did not.
Write down or every, yeah.
Or every I did week. Not, but I did have like a habit tracker thing, like, oh, daily video okay. content. And yeah. I just never did that. Yeah. And then the video itself would have been sort of the writing it down. It's the entry into the world. It's the releasing it, the publishing it.
And then I would also say that like the fact that you, and I have a couple other ideas, but the fact that you didn't do it and that feels like too much, like there's a lot there to
yeah.
talk to somebody, yeah, to process, right?
Yeah.
And to like that could actually be your gem, right? That it's going to, you know, that's going to point you towards a learning about yourself.
Oh, 100%. And also it's one of those, it's kind of what we talked about earlier about the, like the forever, or you make a decision, you got that whole thing. It yeah. like, it was really big. Right. And I want to give you an example that I think you may find interesting. There's a new member in Superhero Institute right now. Good friend of mine. We've been friends, like best friends since like 2012 or 2011 or something. I don't even know at this point. His name's Q Xavier, and he does executive functioning coaching for a lot of mm-hmm. different types mm-hmm. of individuals. And one of the examples he gave me that I thought was so, like, it just sticks in my head, was he was talking with someone about wanted to get better with their finances. Like they wanted mm-hmm. to have more, and they're like, oh, I got this app and I'm doing this. And he's like, here's the challenge I'll give you. Transfer one penny from your checking to your savings account for 30 days.
Yes.
Right. It's yeah. like, it's literally
the perfect example.
It's 30 cents. It's nothing. Yeah. But yeah. to do that every day
yes.
is in and of itself a gigantic accomplishment. And that is as important as whatever else you would do, because it's building a skill, a discipline.
So to make that an experiment, right, it would just be a little in my framework, not mm-hmm. the only way is would just make it like, would just do a little bit more like, where am I at right now? Where do I want to be in the beginning? Mm-hmm. Right. To tap into some strengths. I think that's huge. Right. And then to record, did you do it?
Yeah.
Did you do it? Did you do it? You know, and that brings up the other thing too, is that maybe sometimes we just need some support, you know, and sometimes that shows up as a coach, but sometimes that's just a person that's like, hey, can you just please ask me if I did this?
Yeah.
You know, and that's nothing wrong with that. And chances are that person's going to be like, yes. And can you do it for me too? You know?
Yeah.
Like like sometimes maybe we don't have to do it all ourselves. And that's like, oh, wait, I actually need somebody who's going to check in and is going to push back a little bit.
Yeah.
On this
yeah.
for me.
Where do you fall on? And this is in both in the conversation I was having with my friend Q, but also in some of the science of habits about the importance of the sort of celebration after the fact. Like, where does the acknowledgement and the celebration of our efforts in the experiment come into play? How important is it in the way that you construct your framework? Is it part of this, or is it as part of the follow-up framework? Like, where does us taking time to actually celebrate our wins fit in?
So yes, I love this question. And I'm giggling because full on, honestly, like here's my experience. Like, yes. Love that. It works really well for me. But if you tell me to do it, I'm going to roll my eyes and not do it.
Yeah.
You know, like it's for whatever reason, I'm going to be like, there's a cheesiness factor there that can be, and I'm sure there's some defense, you know, and I'm sure yeah. there's stuff saying a lot about me underneath that. Right. So I think it's learning, and this makes me think of something else too. It's learning, what does celebrating look like for me? And I know a lot of people even can't use that word, right? Like they've got to like frame it differently. Mm-hmm. But that's also very much like a strength-based way of doing things, right? And a looking at rewiring your brain and getting used to a new way of thinking. If you don't have that burst of positive, it's less likely to stick.
100%.
I do think it's incredibly important, and it can be really hard to do. Yeah. And that's the other thing I was thinking about, is sometimes that's where I'm at. Sometimes that's where we're at, is like, I really want this. It's really important, and I can't do it. You know, and just the ability to sit in that space sometimes, and with support, ideally, you know, and you know, is it just the wrong time? Is there stuff you haven't processed yet in your mind? Is there, like, what factors are going into that? Like, I think it's a little deeper than it's most of the time. I don't believe it's a willpower, you know, that whole cringe, twitch, you know, oh, you just don't have any willpower, or oh, you just don't have any motivation, or da-da-da-da-da. Like, okay, maybe, but there's most likely a reason for that, mm-hmm. you know? So I think the celebrating thing too, if you're unable to celebrate, wow, that's an interesting thing to know about yourself, right?
Maybe that's an experiment worth trying out.
Yes. Like, exactly. Like, what if I can celebrate the smallest wins? Like, I brush my teeth, you know? Do you have like a brush your teeth song?
Yeah.
You know, or do you have like, or you play something, or you like practice celebrating.
So I'm going to try and summarize everything that I've learned from you today in how to steal this superpower. And you tell me afterwards what I missed.
Okay.
So the experimental mindset is a method of inducing change in ourselves and could possibly help us induce change in others. And it begins with us understanding first and foremost, what is it that we seek to change? Taking a moment to reflect upon that. Where are we now? And where would we like to be? And then before we jump into it, getting clear on, if we're going to try and make this change, what are all of the myriad of different ways that we could potentially get there? Design ourselves a little experiment, something that is short and sweet, attainable. And then getting clarity around, what are the potential obstacles that are going to be in our way? What are the assets that we have to our advantage? And then just picking something out of one of those things. If one doesn't jump out at us, roll a dice. But don't think too much of it, because it's just a tiny experiment. Give yourself at least 2 weeks, maybe a little bit more. But I'm latching on to 2 weeks. I think that that's a really attainable short experiment. You run the experiment for those 2 weeks. You make whatever that one change is. And you record it in your change journal, essentially. And you want to look for a number of different things. You probably want to look for something in a very objective sense, like what happened, what were the outcomes, whatever thing, how did I feel? Mm-hmm. And then any other sort of like meta criteria that may have affected. It was a rainy day, I just had a fight with someone, and so on and so forth. So something that allows you to kind of capture what was going on at that time when you got whatever the thing was. And after 2 weeks, you stop and you look at it. You decide, am I going to continue on with this because it was great? Am I going to, go a little longer because it wasn't long enough? Am I going to enhance it and go, you know, say, I need to go bigger, I was a little too easy on myself? Or do you just drop it because it didn't feel right for you? And in service of learning how to do this superpower exceptionally well, we can go back to sort of where a lot of this started for you. Understanding how experimental design works, understanding how you design experiments that allow you to really understand what's going on. And then think about for yourself, maybe what, where you fit on the continuum of change, how likely it is that you are one who will change or not change. And then the thing I throw in there is, what is your relationship to certainty? Because the less relationship you have to certainty, the more likely you are to be willing to try something and do some sort of experiment for change. So that's what I'm taking away as a potential way of stealing the superpower for myself. And I think the first experiment I would be running is trying to literally just write anything down for 2 weeks.
Yes.
that is it. Just the ability to track for 2 weeks as sort of an underlying meta skill. That might be.
Yeah. I'd love to see a photo of that when you're done.
Yeah.
You can even blur out what you wrote. I don't care.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. I
Did
love
I miss
it.
Anything?
No, that seems that's really, really well done. And I will just add, one perspective too. I was hanging out with my dad, and my dad's really cerebral, and we were talking about things, and we were talking about one of the reasons we both love the cosmos and astronomy. And it's that when you focus on the universe, when you focus on a galaxy, all of a sudden I feel really insignificant. And that's not a bad thing. That's an amazing thing. right? It's just like there's a component of just lightening up a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, and I think this is, it relates to your uncertainty. You know, like everything isn't quite as crucial as it feels. You know, and so, yeah, I think that's really key. Like, and maybe you can't even believe that. Maybe it doesn't feel like that, but it's like, what if Claire was right? You know, and I'm not that important, and that's a good thing. You know, would you be more willing to try something?
I love it. Well, Claire, thank you for coming on to Rogue and letting us try and steal your superpower. For those of you listening, I hope that you got a lot out of it. I hope you try some experiments. And if you did, make sure to let us know what it is. Come into the Superhero Institute, drop a comment in the community and let us know what it is that you're trying as an experiment. And trust me, someone in the community, at the very least, it will be me, will check in with you and hold you accountable and see how you're doing. And I'm pretty sure Claire would as well. So thanks for joining us on Rogue. See you in the next episode.